Let's get started. Are there any questions before start? So the topic, as I suggested last time, the topics I plan to cover today would be completing the discussion on crawling and then talk about how we can exploit the tag structure in the web pages to improve the IR aspect of it, and then start talking about how to exploit the link structure, and then realize that link structure between pages is sort of analogous to link structure between people in social networks, and then start talking about social networks. So that's basically what we'll be doing today. Before I go there, I wanted to show one slide. Where did we go? And there was a question last class about, is it actually possible to keep the entire inverted index in one place? And if you cannot, then how do you actually keep it across multiple machines? And in fact, I think it's a good topic to discuss when you are talking about web scale information retrieval. Okay, so in fact, you'll read about this when you read the anatomy of Google paper at some point of time. Once we are done with search engine technology, we'll have one class where you'll read that paper and we'll have general discussion about anything else that we haven't covered. But this is basically some of the background on how you can distribute the index. So the inverted index itself could be too large to fit in main memory, point one. And point two, even if it does fit in the main memory, maybe you don't want to have the entire inverted index on one machine and use it to do the retrieval the way we discussed last time. So if you were to split the index, how would you split it? So there are obviously two ways. You remember that an index is nothing but term and where it's appearing. Okay? So the number of rows basically are equal to the number of terms in the lexicon, and then the size of each row corresponds to how many places, how many documents are there, and in how many places in those documents this word is appearing. Okay. Now the size of the inverted index is sort of proportional to both the size of the lexicon and also the size of the document corpus, and indirectly proportional to the number of times this word appears, I mean a word appears on the average in any document in the corpus. Okay. So if all you care about is reducing the memory and you want to split it into multiple pieces, you could either say, think in terms of inverted index at the end of the textbook. Okay, if you cannot put it in one place, then you want to put it in two different books. The inverted index itself is so big, you want to put it in two different books. So the question would be, what would you do? One idea is to provide index of words from A to G in one index, and G to whatever, P in another index, and P to Z in another index. Okay, so you just basically split it in terms of terms. Okay, that's like an obvious idea you would think about. So what you're looking for is alphabetically between A and G, you look at the first index. If it is between G and P, you look at the second index. If it's P, Z, you look at the third index. Okay. Now, there's another way of splitting it too, which is split it by the documents, or in fact, split it by occurrences. In fact, more importantly, inverted index, if you remember, it's not really between terms and documents, it's between terms and occurrences, right? We have this picture. See, you have terms and the occurrences. These are the occurrence lists. Okay? So what I can do is I can split it in terms of the other dimension, which is the occurrences, and it doesn't come to your mind first, because that's like saying, in the textbook example, it's like saying that if I'm looking for the mentions of the word, let's say, page rank, okay, in the index, the first index will tell you where all page rank is appearing in pages 1 to 300. The second index will tell you where all page rank is occurring in pages 301 to 650. And the third will tell you 651 to 10,900. That's the way you're splitting it. So every index has all the terms. The first one tells you the first thing, the second one, so on. Now, could you actually think of a possible reason why this second one would be useful? No, I mean, that's one. Why is it parallel processing? That's actually a very good point. But even from the textbook point of view, let's say, I mean, if I'm using indexes at the end of the textbook, would I ever be interested in having index of this type? A possible idea could be that I, you know, it's like, you know, if you're looking at something like Kanut's Art of Programming, volumes 1, 2, God knows how many, he has written 3 and he's going to write the other 4, right? So for each word, you may want to see where is it appearing in the first volume, and where is it appearing in the second volume, where is it appearing in the third volume, and you're in fact interested mostly in the first volume, okay? And so it's not bad for you at all to just look at the first volume index. Okay, so that's one way of thinking about it. So in some sense, importance, if you want to consider that occurrences in certain documents is more important than occurrences in other documents, this gives you a natural way of separating the documents. But then the other very important point that Manda is bringing up is, in fact, it is also amenable to parallel processing, because you can essentially, if you wind up splitting the index in terms of documents or occurrences, normally the terminology for it is barrels, okay? So you have a barrel 1 of documents, barrel 2 of documents, barrel 3 of documents. For each barrel, there is an index. Okay, now when a query comes, you send the query parallel to all the barrels. All of them do the inverted index-based retrieval, and then all of them bring up top K results. Now, of course, there has to be an extra issue, which is merging top Ks from multiple barrels to make a top K result, which actually is a pretty painful idea. In fact, it's a fundamental challenge in information retrieval. So if I give you 2 ranked lists, how do you merge them? Okay, because it's actually possible that the top 10 from the first barrel are way more important than the top, you know, 1 from the third barrel. So all the ones in the first barrel should come before anything from third barrel. So when you are merging, actually you may be interleaving, for example. But if you can figure out how to interleave and how to merge, this has the advantage that you can actually parallelize the effort. Each barrel can, you know, each machine, I mean, each barrel can be given to a separate node, you know, a separate machine which actually captures the index, and it can be doing the processing on just that barrel, and then compute the top K. Okay? So, yes.
Can you compare the query to the barrel in general, like have some sort of centroid vector for all the documents in the barrel, and that way you could rank the barrel?
You could do that. In fact, the thing is, there is a very close idea. This idea that you have is you actually have a central collection of documents. You actually had, I mean, the idea is we did have all the documents in one place, okay? It's just that to improve processing, we want to split the index across multiple servers. This is a very closely related problem, which is that there are, so in these cases you call them, and if you split them, then you think in terms of barrels of documents. In fact, barrel is not a very standard term. It's going to be used again in the anatomy of Google paper, so I'm just using it, okay? Now, another idea is to think in terms of collections of documents. In fact, a special version of information retrieval problem would be that you give me a query, and I'm trying to figure out I have multiple collections of documents I have with me. These could be the law collection, the music collection, the whatever else collection, or these could be the New York Times collection of news stories, the Sports Illustrated collection of news stories, and so on. And you gave me a query. Now it turns out that I actually can only access these collections separately, because they're all independent collections. So the first question I would have then is, given this query and I have these C1, et cetera, CN collections, right, and here is my Qn query, how do I get top K results by asking all these collections? Okay, one dumb idea, of course, one naive idea would be to get all of these, put them in one single database, then you're fine. Then you basically do whatever we are doing now. But it could be that these collections are autonomous and you cannot actually get everything out of them. Plus they change, you know, all the time. And so you're better off sending a query to them directly. Okay, in that case, you're asking, given this query, which of these collections should I call? Okay, and there is this issue of collection selection problem. And you are asking barrel selection. Okay, in fact, collection selection is done in ways very similar to the kind of thing that you're suggesting, which is take, for example, the collection samples, compute the centroids of them, and see if you have, this is one idea, I mean, they're much better ideas, but, and compare the query to the centroids of the various collections, see which ones seem to be close, and call the top K collection, and then merge the results. Okay, the difference between this and this is, here collections are physical reality. You cannot actually scoop them up and put them in a central database. Here you had a central database, you are splitting it to make your life simple, to actually make processing faster, to make the index sit in main memory, and so on. Okay, so you have the design in front of you, actually. You could still do this. I mean, there's nothing wrong in saying, okay, now I have the query, which barrel should I call, and let me do this in, you know, figure out the centroid-based comparison to the barrels. But nobody that I know actually does it, because it adds extra layer of complexity, extra layer of time. Here you have to do it, because you're going to call outside entities anyway. You know, something which actually does this very closely is something like, how many of you know metacrawler? Or dogpile? These are all search engines which essentially outsource the query to other search engines. Right? And one question would be, which search engine should I call? Of course, you can always call, if it doesn't cost you a thing, you call everybody. On the web, you know, one simple answer to anything is call everybody. But then very quickly people stop responding to you if you call everybody for everything, right? And so you do have to worry about the resource restrictions, and then Metacrawler, for example, has to deal with this, okay? Anyway, so now coming back to our thing, so you can make the barrels and then you can do parallel processing on each of the barrels. You can parallelly process each of the barrels and then merge them. Now one way of avoiding the complexity of merging is, in fact, notice that one problem with the merging is it's sort of blocking. In the sense, in the worst case, I would have to look at all the top 10s from all the barrels to figure out which is my top one that I'm going to show to the user. Do you understand what I'm saying? Because it could very well be that the top one from the barrel and top two from the barrel, etc., all of them are going to come from the last barrel. So you have to wait for all the barrels to get complete before you start sending. It's not like as soon as the results come, you send it out. So you're parallelly processing these things, but there is a bottleneck at the merging time. So how can you reduce that merging time? One idea is to make some barrels more important than others. Okay, so for example, put all the important documents in the first barrel. And first three barrels contain the most important documents. Other barrels contain the less important documents. Okay, now how do you decide which are important? If you have a way of deciding what are important documents, you can use this. And, you know, since all of you already know that things like PageRank exist, right, you could, for example, say high PageRank documents would be put in early barrels, and low PageRank documents can be put in the later barrels. And then, basically, you start responding, you start sending results from the first few barrels, and only consider even looking at the later barrel if you don't have enough results. Okay? That's one idea. Now, here is another different idea, which is a variation of this, which is, here you split the document, right? Each document is in one barrel. Now I can actually split the occurrences, because ultimately the real lowest level thing is the occurrences, not the document. Okay? I can, for example, split occurrences across barrels and say that all the top occurrences in the first 4,000 words in any document will go to the first barrel. Occurrences from 4,000 words to 10,000 words will go to the second document, second barrel, and so on. Okay? You're still doing the same parallel processing. Now, in this case, I would argue that most people tend to, it's a reasonable argument that if your query is appearing at the front of the document, then the document is somehow more relevant to your query than if your query is appearing, if your query keywords are appearing at the 10,000th place in the document. Right? Okay. So this is another way. Now this front and back can easily be changed into high-valued versus low-valued occurrences. So for example, if an occurrence is coming with like bold face with H1, those are high-level, more important occurrences. It doesn't really matter where it's appearing. If it's an H1 occurrence, you know, H1 in the HTML, header words, they are more important than footer size words. This, you know, there is no major theory here. All I'm trying to do is split the inverted index across multiple machines such that I can get the processing done faster by, you know, utilizing parallelism. Okay? And at the same time avoid the bottlenecks of merging to the extent possible. Yes.
How do you know how many results should keep for each barrel?
You don't. That what we are saying essentially is, in fact, in both of these cases, what you wind up doing is consider barrels more often than not, you start sending the answers from the first barrel if the first barrel comes. Okay? And you only want to show top 10, right? So if you actually, for example, consider this is something that you will read again in Anatomy of Google paper. If in fact you take the first 4,000 occurrences plus all the H1, H3, all the header words and put them in one barrel, so irrespective of which document they are, if they're occurring in the first 4,000 words or if they're occurring in the headers, they come in the first barrel. Then I'll argue that I don't even have to look at the rest of the barrels. If I get the top 10 results from the first barrel, then I won't look at the other barrels, which basically means I just send the results from the first barrel up. Okay? Now, actually, result ranking in collection selection. Collection selection, by the way, is a big problem that is, you know, solved in information retrieval community. And then they talk about issues involved in actually doing merging and so on. But as far as we know, any published literature on the general search engines, they punt the problem. You know, they don't really do any reasonable type of merging. You know, you can avoid merging by putting more important documents in more important barrels. Yes. Nothing. They don't. No. All they represent is this. A barrel is a set of occurrences. Oof, I'm sorry. Okay. So here, this decibel, right? It has. This is the first. You know, in the document ID 34. These are all the occurrences. Okay. Position 1, position 2, etc. And then similarly in 3, these are all the occurrences. In 4, these are all the occurrences. So now I essentially have how many occurrences? Let's see. So we have in 20 documents it occurs, and then it has, 6 plus 3 plus 4, that's all? That makes no sense.
The whole thing has not been given.
Oh, the whole thing has not been given. Okay. So I do know the number of occurrences I have here. I'm making a partition on those occurrences. Okay. So I have essentially, think of this whole thing. If I take away the relativization and remember each position with respect to the document as well as the position and the term, right, then I can, in essence, split them in any which way I want, partition them in any which way I want. So each barrel is a partition of the occurrence table.
And all of them are in the main memory?
Yes, you want to put them as much as possible in the main memory. Okay. And the other thing, of course, is that there are competing considerations. If you do actually split, one of the advantages of putting it with respect to the same document, one of the advantages of putting all the occurrence of the same document next to each other contiguously is you don't have to keep on saying document number occurrence, document number occurrence. You can say document number and throw in all the occurrences. Now this is like byte pinching, but really byte pinching is exactly what gets done if you want to squeeze as much as possible your index into the memory you have. Okay, we will again look at this kind of byte pinching when we look at something, basically the connectivity table of the internet. So example, if you want to compute navigation, for example, what are all the pages that are pointing to this page? You can ask most search engines that query, and they have that information anyway, and they have to keep it easily accessible. And that too is a very large structure, and how do you keep that? And keep this distributed index in mind when we talk about things like page rank and talk about efficient ways of computing it. You will again use these sorts of splitting of the connectivity table. Okay. So that's a little about some of the engineering issues. Okay. Now that thing, basically, I'll shift this after this class. I'll shift it back into the IR part of the lecture so that you'll find it in the right place. Now this, we were talking about the crawler, and we essentially said these are the normal steps. You have to have some frontier, some queue of URLs. Okay, into the queue of URLs, you take a URL. So the crawler takes a URL from the URL queue, then it visits it, and then it gets the page. It extracts it. It first checks to see if this page has actually been seen before. If so, then it doesn't even have to extract links from that. Okay. If it did not, then it should extract the links from it, put them into the queue, plus you have the page in front of you, throw it into whoever is doing the indexing. Because it's during the indexing, it's during the crawling that you're getting all the information about the document, which you would then use to construct the inverted index. Okay, so we are just looking at the crawling aspect here. So when you see the document, if the document is there, then you not only extract the links, you also extract the text, all that information, and then put, so that you can put it into the document, into the index. And the other question, of course, is when you extract URLs, then before putting them into the queue, you can ask, has this URL been seen before? And if it's been seen before, don't put it into the queue, because you're unnecessarily increasing the number of ways of coming to the same page. Okay. Now, one of the problems is, this is from the search point of view, this is duplicate node problem. So if you have a graph, right, if you're doing a graph search, here is A, here is B, here is C, here is D, you can go to D from A to B to D, you can go to D from A to C to D. And it's the same D. And you want to avoid putting it every time on the open list, because it's waste. If you get it in two different ways, you will wind up expanding it two different times. Okay. So expansion from the point of view of crawler is actually going and getting that page. Okay. So it would be useful to check duplicates at the level of document itself and also at the level of URL. Now, much of which are there's really no fundamental challenges, but there are engineering challenges. So for example, one issue that you're trying to find is if there is a document, many documents are often kept in multiple places as mirror images of each other. Okay, so in fact, one idea for, let's look at that part, right? If you're looking for the duplicates, let me see. Yeah, if you're looking for duplicates, one idea would be to just compare the URL. If you have, before you actually go and get the document, if you have seen this URL, you will never actually crawl it again. Okay? because you already have seen it once. Now the question of course is that there may be multiple ways of getting to the same document because there are mirror copies of the document. So there are different people maintaining copies of the same document. In which case, the URL will be different. You would go to the document, you will bring it in, then you will find that content is the same. So this is URL scene test, which is easy, and the content scene test is harder because you are actually trying to compare the document to document, except the way to do it is, you are not looking for plagiarism detection, you are just looking for more or less identical documents. Okay, and one idea would be to just do something like a signature for the document, check some sort of a thing, and then use that to see if they are same, then those documents are same. Okay, these are the kinds of tests which are essentially, when they say it's a duplicate, it's guaranteed to be a duplicate. When they say it's not a duplicate, they're probably very close to being a duplicate. But that's okay. So you could avoid, you could use this. Okay. Now, having got the document, so as I said, when you're talking about comparing, you may want to keep a fingerprint for the document so that you can compare the fingerprints of two documents. Okay. Further, of course, you have to keep the entire text of the document. If you're talking about text-based retrieval, you have to keep the text of the document, put it into your index. Okay. That's part of the, so that part is the indexer which is connected to the crawler. One other issue, in fact, really the big issue of crawling is how is the frontier of URLs managed? Okay, how do you put the URL in, how do you take the URL out? Okay, which from the point of view of search strategies, it's like, you know, do you take the URL from the back of the queue, front of the queue, is it a prioritized queue, et cetera, et cetera. Okay, here is basically what Mercator does, if you read the Mercator paper. And it's a reasonable idea, you know, probably the newer ones are doing different ones, but let's at least look at this so that you'll get some idea. What Mercator is doing is, in fact, what is the priority queue has to take into account two things. The URL frontier queue has to take into account two things. One is you want to crawl the important pages first and more often. Okay. The second is you want to avoid hitting the same machine way too often. You have to give it breathing space, otherwise it would just basically disallow you. Okay, so those are the two things. And so the way the Mercator did this is essentially it had two queues. This is the front of the queue where things come into the queue, and then these are the back queues from where the things are taken out and crawled. Okay, and what the front queue was doing essentially is these queues, the front queues are all priority queues. Each queue has a single priority. So this is priority 1, priority 2, priority k. Now you can decide whether 1 means higher or k means higher, whichever convention, you stick one. Okay. Now the question of course is, so a page, when a URL comes in, not pages, URL comes in, you throw it into one of these queues based on the priority you assign to the URL. If it's an important one, you throw it into the, let's assume for the heck of it that 1 means good. 1 means most important, k means least important. Okay, so you want to throw in the most important document that must be crawled as soon as possible in 1, and things which can be crawled later into k. So you give a number to each URL. Now, how do you decide what this number is? It's essentially a domain-specific idea. The things that you can do is you can take into account the importance of the page as measured by the possible set of queries you expect to see. Okay, and if you are something like Google, you would just say page rank is the importance of page. So you would take the page rank of the page as part of deciding its crawling priority. Now the second issue, of course, is how often is the page changing? Now this is something that you would have found out historically, you know, since you have looked at this URL multiple times. Remember that crawlers keep crawling, they never stop. Okay, because you change your page and they come back and look at the page again. So the question is, if this page is changing very often, then the change rate is higher, so you tend to give it a higher priority. And if the page is important, it should be crawled, so you tend to give it a higher priority. If any of them is lower, the priority reduces. Now how do you compare these two? Any which way. Okay. That's basically what you do in terms of placing the URL. Now, once these URLs are here, then you basically take URLs from each of these priority queues in some round robin fashion. Okay, with high probability you take somebody from here, with less probability you take something from here. That way at least starvation would not be there, full starvation won't be there. Okay, and then once you take a URL from out here, then you need to put it into one of the queues here. This is what Marketer is doing. There's not, this is just one engineering solution. And now these queues have different semantics. Each of these queues correspond to a different site. It's kind of, so a site in a sense, the different super site. So for example, asu.edu is a site, let's say. Okay, depending on how many of these queues you have, you can say the whole of asu.edu is one site. And anything which ends in asu.edu is a queue, there is a queue for that. Okay, and similarly, anything that ends in nasa.gov, this is the queue, let's say. And for each queue, you keep into account, based on the politeness considerations, when is the next time, absolute time, when you can send a request. You know, it's your internal politeness. You decide based on, how much time should you elapse before you send one more leap. Okay? And then all you do is, whosoever time comes, you take a guy from there, and whenever somebody asks, give me a link to crawl, whosoever time comes, you take a link from there and let it crawl. Now, this is a reasonable way where you are making sure that the politeness is ensured by this, okay, and priority is ensured by that. There may be other ways. Okay, this is just one idea for crawling. There are a bunch of other things, such as how to extract URLs from the web page. Again, it's an engineering issue. As I mentioned last time, URLs can be tucked away in all sorts of inner recesses of the page. And oftentimes they may either be shown in full absolute URL or relativized with respect to some base. Okay, it's not exactly rocket science, but it's a painful coding to make sure that you do actually get validated URLs out of the page from every corner of the page. Okay, so that's what this is talking about. And wherever, there are many, many places where URLs can occur, and as HTML standards keep evolving, there are even more places where you can throw in URLs and more ways of throwing in URLs. Okay. So, but the crawlers have to deal with it. We talked about duplicates already. Another thing is speed, because if you're crawling, essentially multiple machines are parallelly crawling. Okay, so in fact, in that queue, the back queues basically would, somebody comes and asks, give me something to crawl. That could be a separate machine. Each machine could be crawling separately. Okay? So the question, of course, is, and you want to do these many, many pages. So from the caching server's point of view, it does want to send as many crawls per second as possible. That's exactly why it should be careful not to send all of them to the same exact node, because that node will die. And it's same exact outside machine, because that would die. So caching has to be very powerful. Crawling has to be very powerful and fast. And politeness ensures that you won't put your entire might on the single page. Single node. Okay. But the speed is important, and even small things matter a lot. So for example, one big thing that Marketer paper talks about is the fact that you have to convert a URL into an actual internet address. Right, for which you need the internet address, the number, okay, IP address. And that basically the way you do it is you send it to a DNS server, and those of you, probably most of you know what happens, and if they want to know the real innards, then you probably know it from the networks courses. But this is essentially the closest DNS server is sent and saying, do you know what the IP number is? If either it knows or it knows who to ask to get the IP number, and it will send it to that guy. Okay, if you are asking for one IP number, this is fine. If you are asking for like 100,000 IP numbers per second, and if in fact the server essentially is synchronous, the DNS server is synchronous such that if you ask it one question, until it answers that question, the second question is not accepted. This is the way most normal DNS servers are, and you don't see the difference because you don't just keep looking for name lookup all the time. But for the crawlers, this is a big deal. So one of the weird things that, you know, it point is pointed out in the Mercator paper is the most crawlers write their own non-blocking DNS servers. So they replicate the infrastructure for DNS servers such that they are non-blocking because they need it. And of course, the other thing is if you ever found the IP number for a URL, store it somewhere so that you'll never again ask for it again. Okay, storing it and failing and recomputing is much better than asking again and again. Okay, so that's basically what they're saying. Cache. Read multiple URLs off of the URL frontier on the disk. One of the other issues is the entire frontier cannot sit in the main memory most of the time. So parts of it are sitting on the disk. Okay, so if you are putting it from, you know, back front queues into the back queues, you know, if you're doing it one at a time, you're going one disk seek at a time and you die. Okay, so these issues, the setup costs, etc., become big. Cache the URLs, cache the robot exclusion rules. If you know the site, you already know what its robot.txt is. Don't keep looking at it. You know, keep it. It's a very obvious idea, but makes a difference. Cache the document locally for reprocessing. You know this, right? This basically Google does it now, and people don't like it. I mean, Google, every document it cached, it caches. Now, it doesn't only cache it and use it for its own utility, but it also keeps it for us, which has all sorts of interesting unintended consequences. So if you put up something on the web and your boss told you take it down and you take it down, and in between Google, you know, crawled you, then until they recrawl you, this information is open. And in fact, it happened more recently. You know, my former advisor, he was shifting from one university to another university. And it's still kind of hush-hush. He wasn't telling anybody that it's official, but he told people in his lab. And one of the guys in that lab who has a blog put this up on the blog. And I didn't know. My advisor told me that he was probably going to move. And so I said, okay, let me see whether this guy has moved and, you know, check Google. You know, he's still where he's supposed to be, except, you know, Google essentially points out that he has moved to this other place, but because it's available in the cache. And so you click on the link, you don't see that information. But if you click on the cache, it shows that information. And I asked him, I'm this guy, and he said, well, I told this guy to remove it. He removed it. Google hasn't found out yet. So now there are all sorts of interesting. So it takes like 4 days or whatever is required before they get back to that page and recrawl it. Okay. And then, you know, cache DNS results and, you know, all sorts of things, making sure that if any of the machines fail, you want to make sure that you come back to a consistent state, all of which are very important. I say they are important and probably not showing enough enthusiasm for, you know, saying that they're really important. You know, if you want to write these are very important. Okay. Now, there is this whole other area called focus crawling, which is, if what if your crawler wants to crawl pages of a particular type, not the entire web. All that needs to be done really is, you know, in a sense, you could do one of two things. So suppose if I just wanted to crawl and make a portal for just the bicycling pages. Okay, one idea is if you already have the entire cache of the world, I mean entire crawl of the world, then you just take the piece of it that corresponds to bicycles and say that's the part. A better way is, I mean, if you don't have the crawl of the entire world, and if you want to be complete for this particular subpart, let's say bicycling or computer science paper, okay? So you just want to, you are much more, it's not any URL that comes in, you know, in the way that we were handling the priority queue earlier, any URL that comes in will go into one of those front queues. Okay, but now not every URL will go into front queues. You know, you might say, well, we have nothing to do with bicycling, so I won't put it in. The question is, how can you tell whether a URL is about bicycling or not? One idea is, put it in, bring the document, check if it is about bicycling. But that's waste, because that you already done everything. So the issue would be, able to classify a URL based on the context in which it was occurring in the page where that URL is occurring. Okay, so for example, to be able to tell that if it's a URL on a faculty member's page, it's more likely to be pointing to a paper than if it's a URL on New York Times page, a newspaper's page. And this much is obvious, right? If you're looking for computer science technical reports, you won't be looking at New York Times. I mean, there may be like once in a million years, New York Times would actually post a technical report of a computer science paper on their web version if they're actually talking about some new breakthrough. They'll throw that in. But most of the time, the URLs on the New York Times page will not lead to a computer science technical report. So you can just completely blacklist NY Times. This is the ability to classify URLs before even seeing them. Okay, this is the heart of focused crawling, which is crawling on a particular part of the world, not the entire world. Okay, and classification is connected to learning. So we will talk about this a little bit more when we talk about classification learning. Okay, so this is the aspect of crawling which is connected to learning. Okay, there are other simplistic learning issues that are connected to crawling too. For example, computing the change rate of a URL. One idea would be, we are already doing that. One idea would be to actually use the historical data to figure out how often has it changed. But it's always nice to be able to predict even without having looked at it for long enough time. Based on the type of the page, you might say these kinds of pages don't seem to change that often. Okay? This is something people do now in terms of reducing the number of recrawls to the page. So that's again another place where learning can be used, classification learning can be used. But you know, we will get to this slide later again when we do the classification learning. But just this is connected to crawling. Okay, so it's a nice way to end the crawling thing. Writing a trivial crawler spider is easy. The real issue is making one which is fast, which can work in, you know, web scale, which can bring, you know, continuously work. In fact, crawling never stops. The way we set up the pages, you know, you get crawled, then you go back onto the queue and just wait your turn to come back and crawl again. Okay, so to do this is more interesting. Yeah. So you're talking about how big is the index of a search engine. What do you mean completeness of a crawl? There is no obvious way. In fact, how does one check? In fact, there's an interesting issue as to whether or not, I mean, how does one quantify the size of the index of Google with respect to that of Yahoo or MSN Live without taking their word for it? Do you understand what I'm saying? I mean, you know, if you take their word for it, McDonald's says we served billion people. Jack in the Box says we have served 1.5 billion people, right? It doesn't make any difference. So you shouldn't take their word. You know, you should be able to, I mean, if TV networks decide which are popular shows by themselves, then, you know, everybody will be saying everything is popular. There's a third party, Nielsen, which actually computes the popularity. So similarly, can we, I mean, we do now compute, for example, there is Nielsen for search engine popularity. We do know what percentage of search engine queries go to which search engine. Okay, but how do you, for example, compute how big is Google's index with respect to Yahoo's index? Basically, what you have to do is you have to do it by sampling. And then getting a true random sample is very hard. So there are better and better ways of sampling such that, in fact, the ratio with respect to the samples is also the ratio with respect to, there's good reason to believe that the ratio with respect to samples is also the ratio with respect to the full indexes. But in general, there is no such thing as, is it complete? You can only say, am I more complete? Do I have more documents than this other guy? Okay? I'll send you a link which talks about how such comparisons can be made using sampling techniques. Easy to read. Other questions? Okay. So the other thing is, if you remember, the reason we got into this whole entire crawling thing was this. This is the reason we got into the crawling thing. We said, these are the differences between WebIR and normal IR, and you don't have a corpus, you have to build your own corpus, and that's why you need to know crawling. And web pages have more structure, so you should be able to use that extra structure to improve the ranking of the terms, right? That's what we're going to talk about now. And again, these are things that you are more or less aware of, which is basically there are HTML tags, and they have certain level of importance attached to them. It's not that H1 by itself means more important. It's that H1, if you put H1 and put some text to it, when it is rendered, it appears in bigger font, and people tend to take bigger font to mean more important. And since it's people whom you are trying to impress, it's reasonable to assume that words occurring within the context of an H1 header are more important than those that are appearing in the normal body or with footnote size. Okay? So that's the kind of thing that we're doing for HTML tags. And so there are two main ideas for doing tags, you know, which are both complementary. One, of course, is associate different importance weights to occurrences in different tags. That's what I've been saying. So H1, more important. H2, less important. H3, even lesser important. Okay? So with respect to that idea, in essence, if you can, you know, let's see. I'll come back to this. So if I have, let's say, if I've decided that there are 6 types of occurrences of a word in a document, first type is within H1, second type is within H2, second type, you know, third type is in the normal body, fourth type is within anchor text, and so on. Okay? Now the question, of course, is how do I think of giving them importance weights? You essentially think of, you know, the weights as a vector. Here's a weight vector. And if you actually know the number of occurrences of the term under each of these categories in that document, that would be another vector of the same type, same size. You take the dot product, that would be the normalized, the weighted occurrence importance of that term. Okay, easy enough? Okay, so let's see where. Yeah, so the issue, of course, is how do you compute these weights? What is the best way to give? It's very clear that H1 is more important than H2. H2 is more important than H3. But we want to put it into numbers. Okay, how many times? So if a word is appearing 2 times in the body, 5 times in the body and 1 time in one document and 1 time in the H1 in the other document, are they equal? Is one better than the other? Clearly, there is no obvious answer. Okay, so you can use this kind of a thing, you can train, you can learn, for example. So you can work on, you know, start with a weight vector and do relevance feedback, see which, you know, things people seem to be liking, and based on that, change the weight vector until you get a different one. Okay, for all we know, many of the search engines are possibly doing it right now, but they would never tell you what weights they use. Okay, so all we know is you use a differentiated weight vector for each of the terms. Okay. The other issue, which is kind of connected, is one specific place words appear is in the anchor text. Now, anchor text is actually, you can think of it in the most, you know, in the syntax, in the strict way, which is having, say, a href, and then, you know, Rakaposhi URL, and say, really boring page. And then put that, right? So now, really boring page is part of, and you put this in your page. So really boring page is part of your page now. Those words are part of your page. But they really are referring to this page, because you put it in the anchor text. Because when people see it, they'll say, click here for a really boring page. Okay? So now what's interesting is that these words now are part of this page, and this page doesn't even know it. Because if everybody thinks you're a duck, you're a duck. It doesn't really matter what you think. Okay? And if everybody thinks that Bush is miserable failure, then Bush is miserable failure. That's exactly what the Google bomb and miserable failure is. I mean, how many of you don't know this? If you type miserable failure to Google, you get Bush as the number one hit. Okay? Now, there is an explanation as to why Bush actually won the last election, because most Democrats were sitting at home making these anchor text Google bombs to go, you know, Bush, and they have forgotten that they're supposed to actually go and vote. And that's why, even though he's a miserable failure, apparently, according to Google bomb, he gets elected. Okay, so there's a moral to the story, which is actually you should show up in the election booth. But a separate point, of course, is that anchor text is a very different piece of text. It's in your page, but it's really supposed to be part of the other page, because this is your opinion about that page. Okay? Now, another thing I said was that the strict anchor text is the one that appears between the href and slash a. But sometimes people say, for a really boring page, click. And then write this and say here. Now, unfortunately, here the anchor text is just here. Okay? There is very useful description about this text, this URL outside of it. So the general interpretation of anchor text is the neighborhood. You know, four words are like K words before and K words after where the URL is occurring. That's what normally the general interpretation is. The strict interpretation is exactly the one that appears there. Okay? So now onwards, when I say anchor text, I mean the general one. It also includes the strict one. Okay, there was a raised hand.
That's exactly what I was
asking. Okay. Yeah, the strict versus more general. Yes. What do you mean? I didn't understand your question.
I mean, like,
so there is a text inside of it. Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, if you can bring it up, I mean, it depends on whether or not that stuff gets extracted. So for example, for the longest time, early on, most search engines would just not crawl the innards of a PDF file. PDF file is just like an image. It's binary. Okay? Now most search engines regularly crawl PDF. They also crawl PowerPoint. They also crawl all sorts of various types of documents. It's a question of whether you can invert and get the text out. And if you do it, you know, you can use that to figure, now report back to this. Okay? Yes?
I think this failure yesterday or day before,
you heard it here first. So apparently Bush is no longer the miserable failure. What's more interesting actually is, let's see, we should do some physics experiment. Any campus Republican here? This is just for science. I love Google, not Google, Bush. I hate Google, but I love Bush. Okay. Okay. Yeah. It's no longer Bush, but what's interesting is it's changed. For the longest time, Google, rather than remove the White House link as the first link, they would act as if they would basically profess their, you know, not ignorance, impartiality. It's not against Bush, it's for science. You know, it's the page rank is the comfortable myth that we should all believe in. By the way, none of you should really believe that Google uses page rank. I will teach you and you should all act as if that's the case, and Google guys will tell you, but that's what they did in 98 paper. You know, they do pretty much anything else, you know, plus page rank. So page rank is a comfortable myth, just like motherhood and apple pie, and we should believe in it, right? So they would put Bush, whitehouse.gov would be the first link that would come when you say miserable failure, and then here there would be a sponsored link by Google explaining why did miserable failures point to whitehouse.gov? And then you click on it and they'll give you background on page rank and point out that we are such nice people, we don't want to change the search ranks, which is totally bogus. You know, they just didn't change that one because that was high profile one. There are all sorts of cases where when Google decided that some particular company was playing, you know, doing some things to get their rank, you know, hyped up, they will just come and change the index. In fact, one of the issues is that irrespective of whatever precision you have for, you know, page similarity, however much of a precision you take, even whether you take, let's say, 7-digit precision. Okay, similarity is a number between 0 and 1, right? So you suppose you take 7-digit precision, it still gives large number of pages with the same similarity that you come, you know, right? And the question is, which of them will come in the top 10? And so every once in a while, they basically play with this weight. And, you know, I believe it's called in the industry circles where they actually try to play with the Google ranking to help themselves. It's called the Google dance, where, you know, so for about 2 months, you will be coming at the top of the page, and there'll be a dance, and you will fall down to 1,000. And so nobody knows you exist. And sometimes you fall down because of no mistake of yours. In fact, there's this funny story I read where there was this one guy who was selling large shoes for people with large feet, presumably, you know, unless they just like to have shoes on the wall. And there are many, many people who sell large shoes, and this guy wound up being, for the longest time, the first link that comes on Google's large shoes retriever. So he basically found he doesn't have to buy any advertisement. So he kept quiet, and he was getting tons and tons of things. And one day, suddenly, he stopped getting any orders, and he went and checked, and he found he's no longer in the top 10. Now, there is an actual case on this that was filed against Google. And what's interesting is there are theories as to whether, in fact, this was just a random occurrence or whether Google basically was nudging him to start buying some advertisements. What really did happen is this guy started buying some advertisements and slowly he came back up. So, I mean, I'm starting a JFK conspiracy theory here. But on the other hand, you know, so there are all these interesting issues about what appears in the rank there. And knowing what you know, which is the rank, the way we are looking at these pages and the way we are ranking these things has no connection to reality, you know, of the meaning of the page. It's basically, it should not be surprising at all that what appears in the top 10, most of the cases could be arbitrary. Because I heard this once said, and I would just say it with respect to India because I'm from India, that if you are 1 in 1,000,000, there's still 1 million people like you in India. I heard it about a different country, but you know, I get to say it with respect to India. But that's more or less what we are talking about. Essentially, whatever precision you take for the page rank, there will still be, I mean, for whatever way of combining similarity and page rank, there will still be many, many pages which have same number. And so there's a lot more in the secret sauce that we don't know, that basically anybody can manipulate. Okay. So the most important thing here is that the document is indexed not just with respect to its contents. Now if you want to use the point is that if you want to use the anchor text, it's no longer just part of, see, these words are no longer just part of your page. They're also part of my page because other people think my page is boring. So if I say boring, if somebody says boring, it should come up. And in fact, you know from the Charlie Chaplin lookalike contest where Charlie Chaplin came second, that perception is reality. It doesn't matter what you think you are. You know, it matters what other people think you are. And so in fact, most search engines give higher weight to words that appear in anchor text. So the anchor text stuff, so this is a really boring page, is now part of my page, thanks to you, because you put it on your page and pointed it to my page. Now, most search engines will now say that the boring part, that word is given a higher weight in description of my page. This is not surprising at all. If you are applying for any job, you write a description of yourself saying how you are the greatest thing since sliced bread. And you ask me for writing a reference letter, I'll write a reference letter explaining, you know, whatever type of a loser you might be. And what do you think matters? Everybody cares about the reference letters rather than about what you're saying about yourself. That's given higher weight. Right? So you wind up giving higher weight to the anchor text, which is interesting. And second thing is that now the contents of your page depend upon other pages. So remember, one thing that we were sure of is the document itself doesn't change. And the TF part of the document, the weight of the word doesn't change. It's only the IDF part that changes. Remember we talked about this? Now TF part changes too. I just told you that as you crawl more and more pages, and if many of them are pointing to you with all sorts of four-letter words, then they're all becoming part of your description now. Okay? Now, more often than not, actually, the anchor text winds up being a much better description of your page. In a non-adversarial world, that becomes a much better description of your page. But then, it's also a great way to fool search engines. Google Bomb or any of these search engine bombs are essentially exactly that, right? Because you wrote a miserable failure and pointed to whitehouse.gov. And if enough people do this, and if those people are important, right, then whitehouse.gov would be the first link for miserable failure. Okay? Yeah, so that's all. So in fact, I even experimented with this last time around. It's not all that hard to make a Google bomb for anybody that you want. All you need to do is get a word which hasn't, it's harder to make something like miserable failure point to your front page, because that's a common word. I mean, miserable is a common word, and failure is a common word, whether you like it or not. And so many pages already have those words. So the trick is to pick a word that is sort of looks like English, but nobody really uses it. And then a bunch of you just gang up on your friend and point to that person's page, you know. So I was trying Shmoopy, but Shmoopy unfortunately is very popular because of Seinfeld episode. And so you could try Cuddly, Bubbly, Woogums, and for a while I actually had it working such that if you say that, it'll point to my page. But now it no longer does. I think I removed it, first of all. But that's basically, if it's a non-commonplace keyword, you can make it happen. It's not that hard. Okay. Question? Yes?
There might be something else you can use besides the tag information, because when you use tag information, you look at the text source of the file. The text source of the file not always reflects what the user actually sees on the page, especially with style sheets. You can have the content somewhere at the very top of the text, but it will be actually some hidden stuff at the bottom.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And vice versa. You can have the main content tucked somewhere there, but it pops out of you right here. So maybe, I think I read about it somewhere in some research paper, they try to analyze the geometry of the page, the way it's laid out, and based on that, assign the...
Figure out, that's possible too. So where exactly in the page? And the other biggest trick in the book is, in fact, one of the things that the adversarial nature of the web search is that you can put words that are somehow important in the current, I mean, I talked about it last time, you know, that seem to be most popular keywords, and try to put huge number of those words as the text part of your page, and then put a JPEG image, right, with what it is that you want the users to read. And this is what spammers are doing. Image spam is the biggest thing that we get now. And any of you working in computer vision? There should be one or two. Yeah, so it's your problem. You have to solve this problem, because we are getting way too much image spam. And all because, you know, in fact, there's this way when I teach 471 Intro to AI, I point out that it's one area where what AI can do is just as important as what AI can't do. Because whatever AI cannot do now, is an opportunity for all these guys to use that. You know, basically that's a way of telling, first of all, humans from computers. You know, humans can read images. Computers still can't. Right now, I mean, shifting. Okay. So that's one way in which you can get people to come to your page because of the text. And then you show them a picture which is what the users read. And there's all sorts of other things. In fact, I'll send you a paper and we'll probably talk about this at the time of Anatomy of Google or something. But there is this whole idea of spoofing where you know that when the crawler comes, the crawler has an IP address. You know, Google crawler has, you know, googlebot.com. You know, something else has somethingelse.com. So many pages, depending on who is sending the HTTP address, they show a different face. It's very easy to do. Okay, so googlebot.com, wow, you know, Middle America, we are nice people, we have nothing bad to sell you, and, you know, motherhood and apple pie. And then as soon as crawler is gone and, you know, asu.edu, then they're selling you all pirated everything. You know, so that's fine too. In fact, sometimes you don't want to be indexed for what you are. You want to be indexed for something else, and then people come, and then you sell them something else. Okay. Again, this is the aspect of the adversarial nature of IR. You know, you don't actually see this happening in libraries. I mean, maybe in junior high, sometimes maybe a couple of people will throw in a couple of Playboys in the middle of the science section and something like that. But really, it's not a mass scale phenomenon, right? Whereas this is a mass scale phenomenon on the web, because getting people to see your page is important for you if you're selling something. And so you would always, the guys who are circumventing the system are at least as smart as the guys who made the system, because they're all humans. Okay, our average smarts are almost the same. And so it's not surprising. There's going to be an arms race. Okay. So the other thing, of course, is we want to use link information, okay? And there are, of course, you already are using link information. Part of the, I mean, you can think of why we should use link information in two different ways. One is because with just text similarity, it's impossible to tell the difference between me saying in my page with H1 font that homepage of George W. Bush, okay, and George Bush saying in H1 on his page, homepage of George W. Bush, which is the real George W. Bush, for example, okay. So how does a search engine know? Because the words appear, they all are appearing at the top of the page, they're appearing at about the same size, so how can you tell? So you need some other way of telling which is the real one. Okay, and if it's not George W. Bush, I might say, you know, medical advice on diabetes on my page. And American Medical Association also says medical advice on diabetes. What does the text search engine do? Both of them are exactly saying the exact same words. Even if you do NLP, they're the same thing. So you need to, you know, what we do wind up doing is trust. We sort of talk about which is the more important, more reputed site. Clearly mine is, but that's a different story. So you would have to find out some way of computing reputation of sites, okay? And the idea then is, how do you compute reputation on the web? One idea is things are being linked to each other, and maybe the important pages are being linked to by many, many people. And also, another way of being important, there are two ways of being important. One is many, you know, if you're a very important person, of one type, then everybody knows about you in human society. Another type of importance is you are a very important person because you know a whole bunch of people. And if your friend needs to go and get something done, you'll get to you and say, you know, how do I do this? So it's okay, I'll call friend X. Okay? Both ways, these are two different notions of importance. One is sort of I know people, the other is people know me. No, unfortunately, is not exactly bidirectional. I know Bush, and I don't think he knows me, because I'm not yet in jail. So no is not a bidirectional term, right? So the question is, how many people know you is one type of importance, how many people do you know is another type of importance. I guess in human societies, we tend to think more in terms of how many people know you as the most important, more important type of importance. Okay, what PageRank tries to compute, for example, is in essence how many people know you. Okay, and another idea called authorities and hubs algorithm actually computes both, which is how many people know you as well as how many people do you know. Okay. Now, so you can do this idea of links between pages to figure out the importance of pages, and we can start talking, you know, reeling out the page rank and authority subs algorithms. But before doing that, in essence, what I would like to do is say, well, some other branch has been doing this forever. So let's have some fun talking about them, and then see how do we analyze social networks. How do we analyze social networks, and can we figure out from the analysis of social networks ideas that you can use to web? And it turns out that PageRank authority hubs actually were developed that way. Okay, so it's nice to go back to the masters and see what were they doing so that you might get other ideas. Okay, so I more or less just get to start this today, and then we will have the next whole week basically on social networks and then PageRank and so on. Okay. This is my first slide on the social networks, and it's kind of interesting because when you're talking about social networks, we're talking about networks of humans. Okay. And this one is Typhoid Mary. She was essentially found to be the root cause of a typhoid epidemic at one time in the United States, because she turned out to be a person who was resistant to typhoid, but she was able to spread it. Okay, and in fact, they were trying to figure out how exactly is this typhoid epidemic going around. They were unable to tell who was spreading it, and finally they found this one person who actually, she herself does not get sick because she was resistant, but she was able to be a carrier. Okay, now this is not surprising at all if it is in things other than humans. So for example, things like malaria are, you know, all sorts of diseases are spread by vectors such as mosquitoes, which don't get malaria. But they bite you, you get malaria. Now this poor woman happened to be human, so they put her, you know, essentially quarantined her forever until the epidemic went away. I don't know whether they ever left her out, but it's a very interesting story. And the idea there, of course, is who she interacts with, and then who they interact with. That's a network of interactions between people. And you would be interested in tracking interactions between people to, for example, you know, pinpoint how disease is spread in human population, for example. Okay. This one is similar. They tried to pinpoint, obviously not with very great success, as to who was possibly the first person in the North American continent who probably had HIV AIDS infection. And so this poor guy has that patient zero. He's been dubbed the patient zero. Again, how did they figure this out? They went back through interactions between people to find out who is the first person. Okay, this is from the website. In fact, I normally have this at the beginning of the course to talk about, ask you, just guess what is the probability that any two random pages picked at uniform random from the web page are connected to each other. Connected means you can start from one page, click on some links on that page, get to the pages that you get to click on those links until you reach the other page. That's connectedness. That's what we normally mean. Is there a way of getting my message across to Bush? Yeah, well, I know you know him, he knows somebody who knows Bush. So that's a way. So what is the probability that two random pages on the web are connected? What is it? It turns out that it's pretty high, okay? And to understand that probability, it actually makes sense to figure out how does web look in terms of, if you think of each page on the web as an individual, Okay, how are those individuals connected to each other? And it turns out that back in 1999, now I don't even know where the web looks like this, that they basically found that the large scale topology of the web is more like this. It's like a bow tie. Okay, these were corporate pages, these were pages which only point to other pages. Nobody points to them. These are pages other people point to, but they don't point to anybody. And this is the middle core, which are pages that more or less point to each other with high probability. Okay, so those are the big pieces in the web. And so this is your bow and this is the middle. And all you need to know to and at that time, from a crawl that they did of 17, from a crawl that was done of 44 plus 56 plus 44, plus another 44 plus 17 pages, million pages, okay, they found there are 44 million pages here, 56 million here, 44 million there. Okay, so you can then say it's clear that any page in the union of this and this, any page picked from the union of this and this, will be connected to any page picked from the union of this and this. Agreed? So that's how you compute your probability. And it turns out to be pretty high, as you can see. Okay, and so that's the social network of the web, and it's kind of nice to remember that. And then the last one, and you'll stop here, is this is official Florida presidential ballot, and I'm sure many of you know the 2000 presidential ballot fun stuff. What's interesting about this is not because I like Bush, but because the guy, there was this one guy, I forgot his name, he made this, you know, he looked at the butterfly ballot, the infamous Florida butterfly ballot, and he drew the little cartoon, because he knew how to draw, and so he felt that it was a ridiculous design, so he drew a little cartoon to actually exaggerate the difficulty of picking the right choice, and, you know, showed it to his friends, you know, sent it by a couple of messages to his friends, and, you know, went off on a fishing trip. And he came back after the weekend to find himself basically on CNN and everywhere. Not because Bush people found out, I mean, Ashcraft used to be there, not yet there at that time. So he wasn't found out that way. It's just that his friends then sent it to their friends, and their friends then sent it to their friends, and pretty soon everybody had a copy of this. Too many people had a copy of this, including CNN people, and then they put it on the CNN, and then everybody else had a copy of it. Okay. It took less than a weekend to make a national issue from just a little drawing with the guy not even trying. Why was that possible? Because of connectivity. Because of people sending mails to each other. Now, it's not surprising that if you're worried about connections between humans in terms of disease spreading, you can talk about connections between humans in terms of email virus spreading. Okay, and so in all these cases, you are interested in connectivity between entities and analyzing the connectivity patterns, talking about in a connected network who are more important, who are less important, talking about measures of centrality, and more interestingly, figuring out, and this is really, really the last part, does it actually, you know, many of you kind of have heard of this Kevin Bacon game and 6 degrees of separation, which is if you find any two random people who have not seen each other, people have found that normally it's not that hard to find some 6 people between them, such that this guy knows this guy, this guy knows this guy, this guy knows this guy, etc. This guy knows the last guy. Earth is big, way too many of us, and, you know, billions and billions of people are there, and still there are apparently only 6 people that are separating any 2 people. Should you be surprised at this? It's extremely surprising, but should you be surprised at this? Should you be surprised that if there are 366 people in this room, should be a bigger room, that there definitely are 2 people who have the same birthday? Should you be surprised? No. If you are surprised at that, you should drop the major, because that's a pigeonhole problem. But should you be surprised that if there are more than 20 people in the room, there are more than 20 people in the room, that there is a more than 99% chance that some two people would have the same birthday? Yeah, but actually you can show very using elementary probability that that's the case. And in fact, we will show next time that with elementary probability theory, that most networks are small world networks. That means they have small distances between entities. Okay.